Welcome to the Not All Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang, and this is episode number 226. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, our guest today on the Not All Better Show is Nicholas Kralov. Nicholas Kralov is the executive director of the Washington International Diplomatic Academy, an independent executive education center for diplomats dedicated to strengthening global diplomacy by providing the highest quality training, executive education, and professional development in diplomatic practice to government officials.
How it affects our lives, not only the people in diplomacy or in politics, but all of us, all of the taxpayers who subsidize American diplomacy around the world. And so I will talk about the impact of American diplomacy here at home in the United States, but also around the world.
That, of course, is our guest today, Nicholas Kralov, who will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting What Diplomats Know, an insider's look at a unique profession, a two-part program starting June 28th and then again on July 19th. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via internet phone, Nicholas Kralov. Nicholas Kralov, welcome to the program. You know, there is just so much to talk to you about, and I just want to jump in here immediately. Why don't you tell us briefly what we're going to learn from your multiple Smithsonian sessions, June 28th, and then again, July 19th.
I will talk about how American diplomacy has changed since September 11th, 2001, how the American Foreign Service has changed, what they do, who these people are, where they come from, how we train them, how they represent us overseas. And I will also look at more globally, diplomacy as a profession. What is it today? How is it different from what it might have been 20, 30, 50 years ago? And how are countries prepared or not to practice professional diplomacy? Because unfortunately, diplomacy is very misunderstood by many people, including presidents and prime ministers and ministers and other very high-level political leaders. And it's not something that anybody can just wing. It's something that one should be prepared to do. And it's to me, it's ridiculous to even think that you can send someone to be the ambassador of the United States coming from any other field, any other walk of life, and expect this person to lead an embassy, which, by the way, may have more than 1,000 people working in it. But we keep sending administration after administration, we keep sending these completely unqualified people to be the ambassador of the United States. To me, that's just completely irresponsible.
You're an author, a journalist, a speaker, and an entrepreneur. As an entrepreneur, you are operating the Washington Diplomatic Academy. Tell our audience a little bit about what the Washington Diplomatic Academy is.
So I'm not the diplomat here. I'm the entrepreneur, if you like, because I did create recently the Washington International Diplomatic Academy, which trains both people who are already working as diplomats and people who want to be diplomats. I do teach a few courses, but it's really professional diplomats who teach the overwhelming majority of the courses. Well, actually, except for myself, everybody else is a professional diplomat. And these are people who recently left government, so they most of them have been at least once ambassadors. Of course, we have people who've been assistant secretary of state, under secretary of state, deputy secretary of state. But the reason I did it, since you asked about specifically training and the different things that come with it, I wanted to do this because I saw around the world how countries neglect training their diplomats. They expect them to just make it up as they go. They literally throw them in the deep end and expect them to learn how to swim on their own. And some of diplomacy has to be learned on the job. There is no question about that. The diplomacy is just very unpredictable as a profession, as a career path. And there's such a huge variety of jobs one can have in diplomacy that you do have to learn a lot on the job, even if you say most of it. At the same time, it's possible to lay a foundation, to train people and give them this solid knowledge and then send them out in the world and in the field. And that's why I wanted to create the academy. And I wanted, honestly, I wanted to use all the talent we have in the Washington area, because all these people in the Foreign Service, the U.S. Foreign Service, who retire, you know, most of them stay here. And nobody has asked them to teach anything in their entire career. They've been in the Foreign Service 30, 40 years, and nobody's ever asked them to teach anything. Well, what a waste, right? We have the talent and the skill. And so I thought, why not utilize that skill and that reservoir of talent to help younger generations of diplomats, both American and foreign, to actually become good at what they do?
What should our audience know to better appreciate what diplomats do, both from you and your role, and then from those that are living around the Washington, D.C. area that are maybe 30-year veterans and have seen it all and really have done it? What would you say that they should tell us about how we can appreciate the role of diplomats and the work that they're doing on behalf of our country?
So I assume that most of the people listening and some of those who will come to the lectures of the Smithsonian, in fact, will not be diplomats, and they probably don't know much about diplomacy specifically. Mm-hmm. And what I would like them to know, and first of all, we're all taxpayers. As I said earlier, to me, it's the responsible thing to do, living in a democracy, for us to at least know a little about how our taxpayers' money is being spent overseas, right? In this case, overseas. We have 276 embassies and consulates and other diplomatic missions around the world. My question has always been, do we need all these missions? I'm not saying we don't. I just want to know why we need them. Do we need all these people to work in these buildings, right? If most of what they do can be done from Washington by email and other means, do we really need them to be there? And do we need to be paying for their children's education and for their free housing and, you know, everything else that goes with being in the Foreign Service? Again, I'm a big supporter of the Foreign Service. I wouldn't be doing this if I wasn't. For myself to know, having visited several embassies by then with the Secretary of State and having met many people in the Foreign Service, I just, on a human level, I was interested in their stories. What is it like to be a diplomat? What is it like to live thousands of miles from home, especially if you have, you know, elder parents or sick parents or other relatives? What is it like to raise a family on the go, moving around every 2 or 3 years? How does that affect the child, right? How does that, what when they come back to the U.S.? If you've grown up as a child overseas and you come back into the U.S., what is the cultural shock that you might be experiencing? So very human. As we say in journalism, human interest stories that I want you to tell. And so my conclusion is that what American diplomats do, what the Foreign Service does, affects our lives every day, and we don't even realize it. And for me to, not to simplify, but to make things clearer and less confusing, because things in diplomacy can get confusing very quickly, I always go back to the national interest. And you don't have to have gone to, you know, the Kennedy School at Harvard like I did to learn this, by the way, about the national interest. And that is that there are two most important parts of the national interest: the security of the country and the prosperity of the country. In a democracy, we have the added third component, which is the values that we stand for, although apparently these days values are not that respected by people at the top, but we can talk about that later. So security and prosperity. So what I wanted to do with my book, America's Other Army, was to show how American diplomacy contributes to the security and the prosperity of the American people. Because if I could show that it does, then I could go out to the American people, as I did during my book tour, and explain to them why they should care and why they should support diplomacy and the American Foreign Service. I always am interested in the real life aspect of anything I do, but in this case, diplomacy. It's not just theory. It's not just a nice thing to do. To diplomacy. No, diplomacy. We do diplomacy. We want the diplomacy to be effective. We need to have influence around the world because it affects our citizens. That's the reason.
Well, Nicholas Kraloff, let's dive into your book a little bit. And of course, the title is America's Other Army. We're going to put links within the show notes about where you can find that excellent book. But I'd like to dive into two of those national interests. We'll leave the values subject for just a bit, but let's start with the security issue. How has Foreign Service changed since 9/11 and the start of the war on terror, and where does it go now?
The link between what the Foreign Service does and the security of the American people has become stronger, more visible, more pronounced. Back before 9/11, many diplomats weren't thinking that deeply about, okay, well, here's what I just spent a week or 6 weeks doing this thing. Does it really contribute to the security of the American people, or did I do this just because, you know, I need to have something to do, right? It's the 9/11 made it much clearer that everything we do overseas should contribute to the national interest and any part of the national interest. In terms of security, what happened after 9/11 was a shock to the system because, first of all, we did have this goodwill globally right after 9/11, right? NATO invoked Article 5, the Common Defense Article, and all that. There was an outpouring of support. And then, arguably, we sort of blew it. And what I mean by that, and not just me, but many, many people in government and outside, we focused on the wrong thing. We focused on Saddam Hussein, who turns out wasn't really that much of a threat directly to the United States. Of course, he was a threat to the region. And you can make the case that indirectly he was a threat because the region is always volatile and all that. But the point is the Bush administration or certain members of it tried to make the case that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and 9/11, and there wasn't. In any case, so many countries and many of our diplomats thought we focused on the wrong thing. We should have used the support around the world we got and rallied the world against terrorism. Yes, there was the so-called global war on terror, but it just wasn't, diplomacy wasn't in the center of it. That was really the issue, that the Bush administration didn't use diplomacy as the first tool. It used force. It was the military as the first tool. That sent shockwaves throughout the Foreign Service. One of the reasons was that many other countries started, I think incorrectly, but they started anyway, looking at the United States as a threat to their own security because they thought the Bush administration was militaristic and, you know, wanted to go and do things in other countries like they did in Iraq. So for the American diplomats to be meeting with governments in other countries and to listen to all these tirades and speeches of how the U.S. suddenly became a threat to world security was just something very difficult to swallow. And then we had the duties in the Foreign Service change. Until 9/11, it had been decades since our diplomats had served in war zones, right? Vietnam, really. That generation by then had left the Foreign Service. So diplomats were not used to serving in war zones and wearing boots and having to go through the training they do in West Virginia, you know, how to shoot a gun. They don't carry guns, but they teach them. They have a couple of days of, you know, learning at least how to hold a gun or something like that, because they were being sent into active war zones in Afghanistan, in Iraq, even in places like Pakistan and Sudan and elsewhere. So that was the other part of the shock, that, wait a second, we thought we signed up for, you know, to do something else. We didn't sign up to go and work in war zones. What's going on? Why are we doing this, right? And if you came into the Foreign Service in the 80s or the 90s, you didn't expect to do this. The other part of it was, okay, we, as diplomats, historically, you sort of deal with the world as it is, right? You are mostly a realist. You're sent out there to these countries. You're dependent, your life and that of your family are dependent on conditions in those countries, whether there is clean air, clean water, and access to certain needs you have to, or at least you're used to living in the United States. And so you're very dependent on that. But it also became this question of, all right, the world as it is, and is what we deal with, or what we have dealt with historically. But then the Bush administration started talking about, particularly Condi Rice, about transformational diplomacy, which was about sort of transforming the world or making the world a better place, right? Not just dealing with it. Yes, we still deal with it because we have to, but we also want to get it to a place where it's better, it's more secure, and it's more prosperous. And so that became sort of the, you know, an emphasis on advocacy, not just realism or reporting on what you see in other countries, sending cables back to Washington, but also getting countries to do things in governance. So it became about bringing about good governance. How many countries can we get to that point where they take good care of their people or they practice good governance so they are stable enough, and so that region is stable, and consequently the broader, whether it's the continent or whatever that area we're talking about might be. And so it became this belief in the American government, and this continued on in the Obama administration, that because of these global threats, because we're so interconnected, because of globalization, because of easy travel and all that, the only way for the United States to be truly secure was for as much of the world to be as secure as possible. We weren't going to get the whole world to be fully secure anytime soon. But the point is, they decided that essentially any country was fair game. Any country where we would try to get, through peaceful means, through diplomacy, that this was the second Bush term when Condi Rice was Secretary of State, that we would use diplomacy to try to get other governments to practice good governance. Because again, the belief was that good governance leads to stability. And that, for example, if a country takes good care of its people, then it will not be a breeding ground for terrorists. That was the thinking. Yes.
Makes sense and fascinating. I knew this would be just a wonderful conversation with you. Nicholas Kraloff, one final question. We know you're very busy, but give us a sense as to diplomacy and diplomatic relations under the present administration. Talk a little bit about this subject of national interest in terms of values. And are we missing the mark there? Have other administrations done things radically differently? Give us a little bit of a sense as to kind of the current state of affairs at the State Department.
Well, diplomacy is mostly about influence. If there is one word to describe what diplomacy is about, I think it's influence. Influence doesn't happen overnight. That's a long-term thing. You have to build relationships and mutual understanding and confidence. You have to look at the big picture, right? You have to think strategically. This is not transactional. Diplomacy is not transactional. And that seems to be the main rift between what this president in particular espouses as a philosophy, as an outlook, as a worldview, right? Mm-hmm. Coming from the private sector and particularly from real estate. Mm-hmm. So in diplomacy, transactions, I mean, they're tactical. You can have transactions, but you cannot base your entire diplomacy on what some people refer to as transactional foreign policy. It's just not, in the long run, to use a word that he uses, you know, it's not a winning strategy. Mm. The other part, you know, I'm sure that your listeners have heard the term soft power. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody thinks they understand what that means, but my experience in the past year and a half has been that they don't really. Or maybe they just don't believe in soft power. Maybe they just believe in hard power. So soft power, which, of course, as the term was invented by my former dean at the Kennedy School, Joe Nye, has to do exactly with diplomacy, with the relationships and with the alliances. And that's the other key, the alliances. You cannot have global influence without alliances. And the United States has built these alliances in the last more than 70 years now, since the end of World War II. And it has built those alliances not because we like, not only because, or not necessarily because we like to help other countries for the sake of helping other countries. That's not, wasn't the reason. The reason was that the political leaders of this country back in the late 40s and the 50s and later decided that it is in the best interest of the United States, or it was in the best national interest, if we were to be a global power and if we were to exercise an outsized influence around the world, it was to build this unique network of alliances, transatlantic, transpacific, different parts of the world, both security alliances and then economic alliances. And it was because they decided all the way back then that isolationism just didn't work anymore. And this 70 years ago, what about now, even more so? And they also, I think, understood the strength of a nation like the United States, consisting of people that came from so many other countries, whether you're first generation or second or third generation immigrant. This was, as has been called for many, many years, a melting pot. And so if the United States, the nation of these people from so many different countries speaking all these different languages and having different cultures, the best way to exercise that influence was through strong diplomacy, including the alliances I just said. So what does that mean? You have to have people living in those countries, foreign service lives in foreign countries, who speak the language, they understand the culture, they follow what's the developments in that country, they know the most prominent figures in those societies, not only the politicians, but also the top journalists and academics and NGO leaders, civil society, the top business people in those countries. Because it's not just government to government anymore, right? It's to influence a foreign country, it used to be entirely government. You have to influence the government. These days, with social media and all these other things that globalization brought, it's not enough anymore to just work with the government. You have to influence other parts of society. And so that seems not to be well understood in the current White House, I think, at least from what I see. And this has nothing to do with a political party or against any one person or people that may be working in the White House and elsewhere. Just the attempt that happened under Rex Tillerson at the State Department to just completely gut it, both financially in terms of human resources, and for us to have lost hundreds of superb professional diplomats, for them to be insulted every other day, at least, especially at the beginning, when the message was clear that they were not appreciated, that diplomacy wasn't the tool of first resort. I mean, I'm not going to get into the conflicts with the intelligence community because that's a different story. But it just, again, seems that the emphasis is on force, on military force. Now, you'll say, well, yeah, but look at the North Korea thing. Well, okay, so let's look at North Korea and see what happened. This is, I wish this was about diplomacy. I wish things were done more thoughtfully, that all this was thought through, and I'm not necessarily advocating doing what you do in diplomacy, because as several people have pointed out by now, quite a few things have been tried with North Korea over the past 24 years since the agreed framework of 1994, and nothing has worked to get them to dismantle their nuclear program, right? So yes, fresh new thinking is a welcome. Outside blood, I always think is a good idea, meaning people in diplomacy who come from outside the Foreign Service, because there are many smart, knowledgeable foreign affairs and international relations experts who, in fact, can be helpful. But in this case, the diplomats have been uninvolved, almost uninvolved. Now we're hearing that Sung Kim, who is currently ambassador to the Philippines, but used to be an ambassador to South Korea before that, was the U.S. representative of what was called the six-party talks, which was China, Russia, the United States, South Korea, Japan, and North Korea. These talks were started under the W. Bush administration. So he's actually a Korea-born, South Korea-born American naturalized citizen and diplomat. So he is apparently, finally, they got him involved. But from what I understand, he's not a key figure. And you can't just ignore one of the main democratic institutions of this country. Again, I'm not saying we should do things, we've always done them. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be creative, because we absolutely should. Creativity and innovation is something that I've advocated for years, and I talk about in my book. But unfortunately, I think what's being done resembles more lack of true competence, in a way, of how to do this, in other words, how to get another country to do what you want it to do. So I'm not sure that I would be happy to be proven wrong, but I'm not sure this is just about two personalities, the leaders of the two countries, the U.S. and North Korea. Again, I hope I'm proven wrong, but this type of thing, what we call the CVID, complete verifiable and irreversible denuclearization of North Korea, isn't something that you just agree on over coffee or lunch or dinner or you know, even a one summit. This is a very long process that will consist of many, many back and forths, and will consist of even misunderstanding, because what we mean by one thing doesn't mean that the North Koreans mean the same thing, right? So you need the professionals, and that, again, this is not political. The person in the White House could have been a Democrat, and I would have said the same thing if he or she had done what I see happening now. And that, there's a reason we have these institutions, right? It's some people like to call it deep state. I don't think it's that's accurate, and it's not about that. Public servants, the State Department, any other department, these people became public servants because they want to help the country. They want to serve. They want to follow their leaders. That's what they want to do. But when the leaders don't understand that, when the leaders think that these people who are willing to follow are against them, or for some reason have a different agenda, that's just, there are many examples of Republican presidents coming into office thinking that the Foreign Service is full of Democrats, and they have a different agenda from the Republican president, and that's been proven wrong every time. Reagan changed his mind, George W. Bush changed his mind. Just, you know, go and ask him down in Texas, he'll tell you. But unfortunately, for some reason, there's this complete misperception that the Foreign Service in particular, because it's full of internationalists, people who think that it's a good thing for us to do diplomacy with other countries, for some reason they're branded as Democrats, and not that there's anything wrong with being a Democrat, they think that they're there to undermine the president's agenda. Newt Gingrich used to criticize the State Department a lot in the Bush administration. In the early 2000s, when Colin Powell was Secretary of State, that somehow the State Department was trying to undermine the president's foreign policy. No, there were people in the department who were trying to make the case that maybe a war with Iraq wasn't the best thing to do, right? But once it happened, once the decision was made, they were there. They were there volunteering to go and serve in the war zones. They were there. Right? I mean, they were even before the embassy opened. When still we had the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, we still had diplomats who volunteered to go there and work alongside the military. So we have to start thinking about diplomacy as not something just, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have diplomacy and to have diplomats? And, well, diplomatic is also a misunderstood word. Diplomatic doesn't mean polite or nice, right? I mean, I know that's what people think, but to be a diplomat or diplomacy is about getting things done for your country, getting other countries to do the things that you want them to do, because you make the case that it's in their own interest to do it. And so sometimes you talk tough, right? Diplomacy isn't about niceties. It's about understanding your counterpart, whether it's a partner or opponent, well enough to get them to do what you want them to do.
Nicholas Kralov, what a just a special time this has been with you. Thanks so much. This is important stuff. As an author, a journalist, an analyst, you're recognized for your expertise with American diplomacy. And I just really encourage my audience to attend these sessions. This is going to just be fascinating. But thank you so much, Nicholas Kralov, for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Delighted.
My thanks to our guest today. And please check out our website at notold-better.com for more information and conversation. And thanks to all of you, my wonderful audience, for your charming, encouraging, and advice-driven emails with show and topic suggestions. Please keep them coming at info@notold-better.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at notoldbetter. And you can find us on Facebook as well. We are Not Old Better there on Facebook. Podcasts of the Not Old Better Show are available on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Also on Amazon's Alexa. How are you today, Alexa?
I'm doing great.
Alexa, play the Not Old Better podcast.
Getting the latest episode of the Not Old Better Show. Here it is from TuneIn.
You can always find us online at notold-better.com, where you can find all of our archives. You can share a link, you can get in touch, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm Paul Vogelzang, and please, everyone, let's talk about better. The Not Old Better Show. Thanks, everybody.